Okay, Bert, give me your full name and the year you were born and how old you are.
Okay. Full name is Burton Joseph Hill, and I was born in 1922, and I am 80 years old.
Okay. Now, were you born here?
I was born in a little town in northern Utah by the name of Tremonton, Utah. That was my grandfather's home, and I was born in the parlor of his home by an attending physician that came out in either a buggy or a Model T Ford.
Aha! You didn't have the women that delivered the babies?
Oh, no.
You had a doctor?
I had a doctor.
Oh, that's great.
A full-fledged doctor.
So, how long did you live there?
I lived there till I entered military service for World War II, and I did that on October the 6th of 1942.
Uh-huh.
And I managed to even it up. After 3 years, I was discharged on the same date, October the 6th of 1945.
Were you injured?
No.
Oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness.
Not seriously. I flew 34 combat missions over Germany, and there was a time or two when I got my turret blowed out and a little bit of sprinkling of plexiglass in the side of my face and things like that, but nothing serious enough to warrant a Purple Heart.
What do you think of the war that's going on right now?
I think it's a necessary war, and I really kind of hate to see it going on because I have a grandson mixed up in it, and
so
under the first.
I got a grandson in the Marines.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think it's necessary.
It has to be done. I just don't think that we can allow a person like that to continue on. That's the way I felt during World War II. We had to get Hitler out of power, and
That's right.
I guess we did the job. I don't know.
Well, I think we'll do the job there too.
That's right.
So when did you decide to move to LeGrand?
What happened after I got out of service in 1945, my father had already moved to LeGrand because he was raised here in LeGrand from the age of 7 till he was 22.
Oh.
Somerville, Oregon.
Oh.
And so I came up to help him do the final move because he had his Utah place sold and he bought the one here in Cove, Oregon. And I also wanted to know what he liked so well about Oregon because I was considering maybe staying in Utah and getting a little farm down there. But when I got up here, I never did return.
You fell in love with this valley like all of us did.
Yeah.
Definitely. This valley, I tell you, is so wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
Well, what's some of your first memories?
What's some of my first ones?
Uh-huh.
Well, probably about the first memories I had was we were in the horse and buggy age, and we had a car that I can remember when I was just a little guy, but the only thing that I remember about that car, it was a 1924 Model T Ford, and it never did run that I know of.
Uh-huh.
My cousin, Joe Woodruff, was a self-made mechanic in those days, and he was working on the engine, and then my dad ever so often would hook a team of horses on it, and Joe would get behind the wheel and they'd try to start the engine, but I don't ever remember of it ever starting.
Oh, that was discouraging, wasn't it?
So Dad just had to rely on the horse and buggy and wagons and whatnot for transportation. We had saddle horses too that I learned to ride at a very young age. I don't even remember when I learned to ride. But in 1929, I think it was, my dad managed to buy a used 1927 Model T Ford with a rumble seat, and it ran. It was a good outfit.
Great.
So I remember him picking us up from school when he bought it and hauling us home, and that was really
quite a thrill to be picked up at school.
It had side curtains and everything that went with them.
My gosh. Now, did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had six brothers and one sister.
Oh, marvelous.
Yeah, there were seven of us in the family.
Where are some of them?
And so Clinton is the oldest one. He's still alive, and he's in Mesa, Arizona. Wendell is the next one, and he's in Kaysville, Utah, and still alive. Ralph is here in La Grande, and he has Alzheimer's, and he's in...
Yeah, I know Miriam.
Wildflower.
Miriam's in my family home evening group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I'm the next one. I'm number four, and I was definitely supposed to be a girl, but it didn't happen. So the next one after me was a girl, and that's where the girl fit in. And then there was two more boys.
I bet she got spoiled.
Yeah. Yeah, she did. picked on her, too.
Yes, all those brothers picking on her. Oh. What do you remember as some of your pranks and things when you were young that you did?
Oh, I'm sure I was full of mischief at a very young age, but I don't remember anything too dramatic until I was in grade school, and I had a friend by the name of Deverl Manlow, and the two of us would get together every time we got a chance, and most of the time Deverl would come down to our farm because I had to milk cows and things like that. And so it was Halloween time, and we felt like that we'd been cheating ourselves because we hadn't been getting in on any of the mischief, and so we proceeded to put our neighbor machinery in a kind of a drainage ditch. It must have been very evident who did it because he got a hold of us and he told us, you put them in, now you get them back out.
Was there water running in it?
Yeah. So by that time I was old enough to take care of the horses and so forth, and we had a gentle horse there that we cultivated with, and he'd pull by himself. He didn't have to have a teammate. And so we took him up there and pulled all the machinery out.
It wasn't quite worth it, was it?
No.
Oh, now
just
did
about
you,
cured me.
Did you go through the prohibition time?
Did I go through which?
The prohibition of liquor?
Yes. It was prohibition time when I first remember as a young man, and I remember that my older brothers, they was with a group of kids, and they were always tempted to go to these moonshine places and see if they could get some of that.
Uh-huh. They weren't successful.
They didn't do too well.
Well, they had to be so careful that they probably didn't want no kids around there that might let them know where they were.
I remember when, let's see, I'm trying to think. Well, Heber J. Grant, I'm sure, was the prophet,
uh-huh.
And that's when they abolished Prohibition.
Oh.
And so I had an uncle that was very adamant that Prohibition was a good thing. And so when, I think it was kind of sanctioned and endorsed by Heber J. Grant because it proved to be that we was better off without Prohibition than we was with Prohibition. There were too many people dying from rotten moonshine and things like that. But anyway, it was abolished, and I remember that. I was still a pretty young guy.
So you're a member of the LDS Church?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And have been all your life?
Yeah, I was born under the covenant.
Uh-huh. That's great, I think.
I guess one of my early recollections about the church was our Sunday school teacher took us the class, the whole class, and there was about 30-some of us, and put us on a bus, and we went to Salt Lake City,
uh-huh.
And went to the old Hotel Utah, which is now the Joseph Smith Memorial Building, and we stayed down in the ground floor lobby and waited. We lined up there and we waited for President Heber J. Grant to come down, and we filed past him, and he shook every one of our hands.
Oh.
And I was just telling him yesterday when I bore my testimony in church that that is my earliest recollection of testimony. I knew that he was a prophet.
Oh, that was wonderful.
Yeah. I had tingling going up my spine that you can't believe.
I believe it. I believe it.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. These are some questions that are just to trigger your memories. Did you have pets?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
We had a saddle horse. We called him Old Spot.
Uh-huh.
And he's a Tennessee Walker and an American saddle horse cross.
Uh-huh.
But he'd got his foot injured in a wire cut. They used to get their feet in barbed wire fences, and he had it severely cut down in the hoof area. And so it grew back kind of
crooked.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so he was a good old stable horse for all us young guys to learn on. And so we rode him, and Dad's only thing that he told us about riding the saddle horse, he says, you can ride him all you want to, but if he starts limping, I want you to quit and put him in the corral so he can rest.
Uh-huh.
So then we branched out from that, and of course, being innovative and wanting to try something all the time, we took turns breaking the workhorses to ride. And the smaller workhorses.
You could hardly straddle them, couldn't
you? Yeah, smaller workhorses made pretty good saddle horses, a lot of them.
Oh, be darned. I used to stay at my sister's ranch, and we would get on the horse, mind you, in the stall, in the barn.
Yeah.
And just kind of ride him around in the stall. He got sick of it, and my cousin was sitting facing his rear. He started bucking and bucked her off and broke her wrist.
Oh, no.
Teach us, huh?
Yeah.
Some of the things we do.
But we did an awful lot of things. Everything we did in the farming game was with horses.
Oh, yes.
And my dad was a very good teamster, and we never, ever had a runaway until later on in life. I was probably 12, 14 years old, and what they call brain fever.
Uh-huh.
hit our herd of horses, and it took every one of them except Old Spot.
Well, for gosh sake.
So we had five workhorses that I remember at the time, and they all died of brain fever.
Oh, how tragic.
So we had to, and it happened just before the sugar beet harvest in the fall of the year. And we had a neighbor that had a lot of horses, and he lost a lot of horses to brain fever too, but he managed to get enough of them through, so he got his sugar beets harvested, and then he loaned his horses to us to harvest our sugar beets while we accumulated some more. So
I was just going to ask you, which you raised on the farm, or which you did?
Yeah, we went out and got new horses and so forth, and some of them Dad had to buy just at the auction in the Ogden stockyards, you know. And I remember one of them that was a real runaway.
Oh.
And we didn't have any problems with him to start with, because our dad knew that he was that type of horse. And so every morning before he'd put him to work in the field, he'd take him, put him on the hay wagon with another horse, and he'd run him around the field. Get him good and tired.
Smart. Very smart. Well, how big was the ranch?
It was 85 acres of irrigated land, and we grew a lot of sugar beets. Before I was born, while they were still raising sugar beets, and of course there was only three that were big enough to help Dad top them and thin them, and that was all hand labor. So they was raising about 20 or 25 acres a year. And when I came along and got so as I could thin also, we increased it to about 35 acres of sugar beets that we had to thin and top.
Great.
Every year, and that was quite a chore.
Yes, I'm sure it was. So when he sold out while you were in the service,
mm-hmm.
and moved here,
uh-huh.
to the Cove area,
mm-hmm.
What did the farm do here?
He bought the farm below the one where we're sitting right now.
Where you just were?
That's across the road from, right down on the same side of the road. He had the farm there, and he bought that,
uh-huh.
from Royal Allen. And the next spring, I was looking desperately for a farm too, and so We came up here to Herman Allen, which was a brother to Royal Allen, and talked with him, and he decided that he would sell his farm.
Great.
So coming out of the service and not having very much money, my dad had some money from the sale of the one in Utah, and so he made the arrangements for the purchase of the farm, and so I just rented it from him for the first 3 years, I think it was, and then I started buying it.
Now, how big was that place?
The one that he had was 140 acres, and the one that I bought here was 120 acres.
So now, have you ended up with your father's?
No, I when my father's place come for sale, I was sawmilling at the time for the Fir Pine Lumber Company.
Uh-huh.
And I had decided that I could make more money with $50 worth of tools in a toolbox than I could buy an expensive machinery and spreading out on the farm. So I chose to turn it down and let somebody else buy it.
Uh-huh.
So I kept the farm that I had, but I was, by that time, I was off working for sawmills, and I never did quit working for sawmills until I got laid off and got hired by the Union Pacific Railroad.
Aha! Uh-huh. About what year was that?
That was in 1960.
Did you start working for the railroad?
Yeah, that's the year that our youngest son was born, and so I moved off the farm when I went to work for Union Pacific Railroad, and moved into LeGrand, but I came back out. I drove out here and farmed it, and then my older children kind of had to take over because I was out of town more than I was in town.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I can imagine. Well,
yeah.
Let's see. Let's get back to like the first day of school. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do remember the first day of school. I was pretty young. My birthday wasn't until November, and I started in September, so I was five plus.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't 6 years old yet, and I really liked to play. And I can remember the first day in school that I had a terrible time settling down. The teacher kept saying, "Burton, now if you and your playmate down there will give me your attention, why we'll see if we can teach you something."
Did they use a ruler on you or anything in those days?
No. They'd kind of got past that. I think my granddad had a ruler used on him.
Uh-huh.
He went to the first grade and he got a little bit unruly, and the teacher raised this sharp ruler up and had his hand laying in her hand, and she was coming down with this ruler, and it would have cut him. And he was just like any normal child.
Jerked.
He jerked his hand out of the way, and she cut hers, and he didn't stop to see what was going on. He bailed out the window. And that was the end of my grandfather Woodruff's education.
Oh.
He never had another day of school.
He never went back, huh?
No.
Oh, that's
so
bad.
He couldn't really read or write real good, you know. He
uh-huh.
he learned enough to get by, but he had to have people write letters for him. And
well, did his wife?
His wife did, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she came from Denmark, and she'd joined the church over there along with her mother, and they migrated to Salt Lake, and then it was after she'd migrated to Salt Lake somehow or another, granddad and her got together and got married.
Uh-huh.
My granddad, he was a rough cowboy type, and he'd always break horses, and a lot of times it was on Sunday afternoons that the whole area around Tremonton would congregate there and watch him ride these bucking broncos.
Oh my.
And so that's how he met my grandmother. He was breaking one of them bucking broncos, and she was walking down a lane, and this bronco took off running, and he couldn't get it stopped, and it went running past her and almost knocked her over.
Oh, my gosh.
And she says, "That awful man." She says, "I'll never marry a man like that." And she did. Later on,
darned.
She married him.
I'll be darned.
She was a nice little... What do you call it? Denmark lady.
Yeah, yeah.
She spoke English pretty good, but her mother never did learn to speak English. She used to sing Danish songs to me, and I memorized them, and I still can sing them today.
Oh, that's wonderful. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my family was from Czechoslovakia.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you remember school bully? Almost every school has a bully.
Yeah, we had several school bullies. I wasn't really bothered too much by the bullies because I was really athletic as a young man, and if I couldn't lick them, why I could outrun them. I was pretty feisty, too.
Well, that's good. They're not going to pick on me. Okay. These are just, let's see. Okay, let's get to your courtship and your marriage.
Okay. I had a real good friend, a boyfriend by the name of Vay Jensen, and when we were probably sophomores in high school, why, we both decided that we wasn't as bashful as we thought we was, and we got mixed up in a few of these tag dances at the high school and got to really liking dancing. And so then we were a couple of guys that we wanted to show the girls that we wasn't hung up on any girl, so we tried to see how many girls we could date at that. And I lost track. I dated so many. And we thought it was pretty macho to take a different girl every time. Until junior year, I had a boyfriend from Howell, Utah, that had a Model A Ford, and he drove all over the country, and that was a big deal for us at that time, because if we got a chance to drive the old Model T, we were lucky.
Oh, yeah.
And so he dated quite a bit at a young age, and he had three cousins that lived out there in Howell, and my wife Eileen was one of them. And so he tried to keep them all busy. He was rotating. And he brought Eileen, that's my wife now, Eileen Cutler, he brought her to the Red and White Dance, which is the Bear River High School's annual dance.
Uh-huh.
And our colors was red and white. And she was from Box Elder High School, and their colors was purple and white. So when he brought her up to the dance, why, we traded dances on a dance card, and we traded several dances that evening, and when the evening was over, well, I decided that I liked her pretty good, so
uh-huh.
So I started dating her a little bit more seriously, and this boyfriend of mine, he used to, when we'd walk around up at Bear River High School, well, he used to say, "I'm mad at you. You cut my grass." He stole one of my girlfriends.
Oh.
I says, "You can't handle all three of them."
No, you don't need that many.
So I went with her quite steady for a while, but I also had another girlfriend that I had a crush on from my little hometown that also went to Box Elder. And, of course, I was still playing the field and dating a lot of them besides. And so, long came World War II,
uh-huh.
And it kind of changed the whole picture.
Now, when you went on dates then, did you go to the movies? What did you do?
Yeah, we went to the movies, and we danced an awful lot. Oh, there was a lot of dances. Every dance that either the high schools had or our local dances in our town, well, we'd always get a girl and go to those dances. So we got so we'd rather dance than eat.
Well, yeah, I always loved to dance. Did you have box socials?
Was yes. That? Yeah, we had box socials. I had quite a few of these where, let's see, how did that work? Anyway, the girls all brought a lunchbox.
Mm-hmm, decorated
and,
it.
And then boys, I don't think we bid on them. Maybe not at that young age. I think we drew lots to start with,
uh-huh.
And whatever name we got out
tried
of that.
Tried to find out the name of the yeah. box of the girl that you wanted to eat with, I bet, ahead of time. Yeah.
Yeah, we had lots of that type of socials, and we were busy getting the socials. interesting, this friend that I mentioned I had by the name of A. Jensen, they had a big dairy farm, and we had about 7 or 8 milk cows, and we milked them by hand, and they had a milking machine, because they milked about 20 or so. And so we were active in church, and we'd always go to church, and one of the reasons that I went to church so steady is my dad was a little bit inactive, and my mother, she was the one that seen that we go to church, and so this May Jensen was pretty faithful as my friend. And then I had a girlfriend by the name of Lorene Jensen, and she was pretty faithful in church too. So we always made sure that we went to our sacrament meetings, the way we'd work that out, he lived about 5 miles from me, and our transportation was bicycle. So we would, when we get through with our early morning meetings at church, then we'd go home, and generally we'd come down to my place to play for the afternoon. And when it got milking time, they were pretty fussy about when they milked the dairy herd, regular hours, so it didn't matter at our house. Dad had let me get away with milking them earlier or later. So we'd milk my cows, and he'd help me hand milk those cows, and then we'd get on our bicycles and ride over to his place, and then we'd use the milking machine on that dairy herd,
uh-huh.
And we'd get them all milked and get cleaned up just in time to go to our sacrament meetings, and they were at night.
Oh, they were at night?
Yeah, they were 7:30 in the evening.
Well, for God's sake. Oh.
They were that way for years.
Uh-huh.
I think clear up until they were here in Union, too, when I moved up here. When they came out with what they call a block plan, the 3-hour block plan, that's when they changed them to
uh-huh.
daytime.
Of course, as a convert, I didn't see any of that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Now, let's see, what about the war?
Yeah.
Tell me something about the war.
I had another friend besides this Bay Jensen that was a pretty close friend, and his name was Claire Anderson, and he was about a year older than I was, and the war was pretty exciting to us at that time. We thought that we really ought to be involved in it, and so I tried to get my dad to sign for me. I was only 18 years old, and you had to be 21 before you didn't have to have a signer. So I tried to get him to sign for me to go into the Air Force. I wanted to fly a jet, or not a jet,
a plane,
a pursuit plane.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to be my own boss up there flying a plane, and I was going to go get him, you know. And so anyway, this Claire Anderson, he decided that if my dad wouldn't sign for me to go fly a plane, why didn't I go to airplane mechanic school? There was openings for airplane mechanics, and so he said, I'll go sign up with you. So as young as we were, we thought that if we signed up together, we'd probably stay together in an office. So we went down to Ogden, and we'd signed up, and we was getting our physical, and the ones that passed their physical, they were in the Army. And the ones that failed, they went back home. And so I went down there, and of course I passed my physical flying colors, but Claire Anderson didn't.
Oh, he didn't? I'll be darned.
So I went in the military, and he went home.
Oh, for God's sake.
So anyway, just to show you a little bit about what a young guy gets himself into there, I hadn't been away from home all that much, and so when I got through with my physical and all that stuff, I was taken to Fort Lewis. Oh, not Fort Lewis, Fort Douglas. Fort Douglas, Utah.
Uh-huh.
And given a bunk, and they issued me some clothes for a new recruit, you know. And I stayed there overnight, and the next evening we were taken down to the Ogden Railroad Depot and loaded on a troop train. the troop train didn't stop. I had some choices where I wanted to take my basic training, and I looked at the paper wrong, and I thought it said Boeing Field, and I knew that Boeing Field was in Seattle, Washington, but it said Bowman Field.
Oh, and where was that?
And Bowman Field is in Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, my gosh.
So I went to Louisville, Kentucky for basic training, and that was the first time that I'd been anywhere near that far away from home.
Got pretty homesick, didn't you?
Oh, I got home.
I know. Yeah,
I remember how homesick I got.
My son did, too.
Yeah. I got so homesick that I even considered going
AWOL,
but I knew what would happen if I did, so I didn't go.
So then your dad never did sign, or you were able to do that without his signature?
I was able to do that without his signature.
Uh-huh.
Well, wait a minute. No, I was not, because that's right. He said that he would sign for me to go to mechanic school.
Uh-huh.
I had that, and so he did sign the paper.
So then you learned to be the mechanic.
And so I went to Gulfport, Mississippi after I got through with basic training. And that's where I went to airplane mechanic school.
Uh-huh. But then you got to fly, didn't you?
It's a long...
Did you become a pilot?
Yeah, no. Okay.
Okay, so you didn't get to be a pilot,
no.
But...
I'll go back to the rest of the story on that, I guess. I got through airplane mechanic school, and during the time that I went to airplane mechanic school, I had a wisdom tooth that was bothering me one night, and so I went and had the wisdom tooth pulled out, and I was green enough that I figured I had to be to all of my classes, and I felt pretty rocky, and so I didn't go to dinner that night. We was going to night school, and so I laid down in an airplane there and tried to get a little rest. During that time, and it was in the winter time, and it was cold and clammy, and I got exposed a little too much, I guess, and I got what they call a dry socket in that wisdom tooth.
Oh, dear.
So the next morning, I was really feeling bad, so I got one of the soldiers to go get me a bottle of Orange Crush. I figured I could drink that, and it'd be pretty good stuff. And so he got that, and it almost made me upset to my stomach, and so I knew I was burning up with fever, and so I asked one of them if they'd go get the commanding officer and tell him that I needed to go to the hospital. So they brought the commanding officer in, and he quizzed me a little bit about how was I feeling and what was the problem, and I told him I had a wisdom tooth taken out the day before. So he said, well, are you feeling really bad? Do we need to haul you to the hospital, or do you think you could walk to the hospital? And I said, I think I could walk to the hospital. So I got up out of bed, and I headed for the hospital, and I didn't know exactly where it was, but it was about a half a mile across the base. And I remember walking towards the hospital, and the farther I walked, the more I felt like I wanted to lay down and go to sleep. And the last I remembered of that deal, I walked in the hospital door, and they admitted me into a bed. And then I didn't remember anything at all for about 3 days.
Oh, my.
And I woke up looking up, and I looked in the face of the dentist that had taken my tooth out, and some surgeon, and a nurse. And they were talking about what they was going to do with me, and I finally realized that what they was talking about was trying to get that to open up without having to have surgery, and so then they after their conference, they left a message there that I was supposed to gargle with hot salt water. I think it was every half hour or something like that, and try to break that loose in there. And so I did that for the rest of that day, and then the next morning they came in and quizzed me and wanted to know if there was any drainage in there, and my face was all puffed up by then on the side where the tooth had come out. And I said, no, I couldn't tell that there was any drainage, and so they decided that they would operate on me, so they put me on a rolling stretcher or whatever and rolled me to an operating room. And I remember the operating process really well because they operated on the side of my face here by doing it with Novocaine. And they'd cut the side of my face there until it felt just like what it was.
Oh my gosh.
Me with a knife, and I'd about turn the hospital bed over. They had me all strapped down. And when they'd see me winch like that, why, they'd give me another shot. Novocaine. So they finally got me operated on and sent back to the bed. And I recuperated from that fairly fast. And so then they gave me some, what was it they put on there? They put something on that wound. They made it in a crease, laying in there. They made it in a crease so it wouldn't show so bad later from the scar. And so they put silver nitrate on it, and that kind of burned it and caused it to heal a little bit more completely. And I was feeling good enough then to be up and around, and so they gave me a chore to do, and they had a lot of, there's about 30 people in each one of those hospital rooms, and so they found out that I could roll things up and down the aisle, and so they gave me a cart and had me go down and get the trays and stuff for everybody to eat and bring it down. Then I'd eat there with them, and then when it was all through, I'd roll the trays back. So that went on for about a week, and as I'd go up and down the halls, why, people would look at me, and with that silver nitrate burning down across here, it looked like my throat was cut.
Oh, my gosh.
And they'd stop and say, "What happened to you?" And I said, "Oh, I just had an operation." It looked like you had your throat cut.
Not like it, too.
So anyway, I got over that and got back out of the hospital, and then I went back and finished up airplane mechanic school.
Yeah. And so then you got to be a gunner.
No, from there they didn't. I didn't have a choice on this next move. They just automatically moved me off to Chanute Field, Illinois. That's by Rand Toul and Champaign, Urbana, and they have a college there. And so we went to Airplane Instrument School there. That was taught by the Army also in a barracks there and so forth. And so I graduated as a instrument technician, they call it. And from there, I was sent to Holyoke, Massachusetts. Westover Field was the name of the field. And I hadn't, I'd been in schools and things like that, and I had been away from home now from the time that I left and was so homesick. I'd been away a full year. So I'd pretty well got over the homesickness, but I hadn't got over wanting to go home. So they gave me a 10-day leave of absence then. And that was my first furlough after I'd
been home
in the
Army. Good.
And when I graduated from airplane instrument school, why, I became a corporal. I got two stripes. So then when I got through with my furlough, I went back to Massachusetts and was assigned to a P-47 outfit, and they moved us from Holyoke, Massachusetts to Norfolk, Virginia, the whole outfit. And we were in phase training at Norfolk, Virginia for a while.
Got to know the United States, didn't you?
Yeah, and I tell everybody that during World War II, and it's a fact, I was in every state in the Union during World War II, because Hawaii and Alaska were not states. So, on a troop train. But I did a lot of travel. And so when I got down there at Holyoke, down at Gulfport, Norfolk, Virginia. That's known as a Navy town, but we were down there on a little base, and they had a flight strip there for flying these P-47s. So I proceeded to try to do my job. My job was supposed to be that I'd get on each one of these airplanes and check their instruments and see if they were all functioning right. And if they weren't functioning right, well, we were just told to take the old instrument out and replace it with a new one.
Uh-huh.
So I started trying to do my duty, and I'd get on these airplanes. And the very first one that I got up there in the cockpit and was checking the instruments, why, the crew chief hollered up and said, "Hey, what are you doing in my airplane?" And I said, "Checking the instruments." He says, "Not on my plane, you don't." And I said, "Well, I'm the instrument technician. That's what I graduated in. I'm supposed to check all the instruments." And he said, "Not on my plane, you don't."
He didn't know that you could do it.
So I tried another plane or two, and I got the same kind of reception. So I was kind of between and betwixt. And so I went to the commanding officer, and I asked him, did I have a job in this outfit, this fighter outfit? And I'd learned that they were scheduled to go to France.
Uh-huh.
And so I thought, if I don't have a job, why, I'm not going with them if I can help it. So he said, well, he didn't. He said, well, why do you ask that question? And I told him. And he said, well, I really don't know for sure what's going on there, but I'll find out, and I'll have an answer for you in a couple of days. So I said, well, okay. I said, I haven't been able to get a pass.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been able to get a pass to go off the base. So do you suppose that while you're finding out that I could go over to Norfolk, Virginia? And he says, yeah, I'll see your first sergeant. He'll give you a pass. And so I saw the first sergeant, and he gave me a pass, and I went over to Norfolk, Virginia. I went over to Newport News, Virginia, across the bay.
Oh.
I had to go by a ferry. And when I got over there, before I ever got on the base to look around, right there at the gate, they had guys there with a book, and they were signing everybody up. They were signing their names. And so I said, what's going on here? And they said, we're signing up for cadet training. And I said, well, I'm with an outfit across the base over here. I told them what outfit it was. And I said, I just found out that I don't seem to have a job with that outfit, and they're going to ship over one these days. Is there a chance I could sign that paper? And he says, anybody can sign it. So I signed the paper and never thought too much about it. And when I went back to the base, instead of me going in to see the commanding officer, he called for me to come in and see. And so I was at attention, and he started in. He says, what is it you want, soldier? And I said, what do you mean, sir? And he says, when you went over to Newport News, I see that you signed up to be a cadet. And I says, yes, sir, that's what I always wanted to be, you know, a cadet. He says, well, he says, you've spoiled my whole day. And I said, I'm sorry, sir. I saluted him. And he says, get your stuff packed. He says, I'll have a Jeep over here to pick you up. And he said, I've got to get a Jeep out of the enclosure over there where they keep the mechanical stuff. And I've got to get you down to the ferry and get you over to Newport News. And you're leaving us, soldier. You're no longer with us.
Well, so great.
I said, well, okay, I'll get packed then. So I left, and I went and packed up, and there was the Jeep, and he took me over. And they just, the base over there, Newport News, was just full of guys running around there with stripes on like I had, corporals and whatnot. And I thought, well, what's going on? So I didn't have to wait too long, and they started giving us tests. And they gave us tests every day for a week.
Oh, my gosh.
I didn't know that they had so many tests in the Army. And so what they were after, they were having a terrible time getting gunners. And so that was their way of opening things up so that they would probably get some gunners. And they gave tests to everybody on the base for a week. And at the end of the week, they published a list on the bulletin board of the scores that we got. And it says, in order to go on to cadet training, you must have a score of 74% or above. So I hurried and scanned the list, and I found my name, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I had 73.
Oh, 1 point less. Oh.
So I got washed out, just like if I'd have got 1%.
Got it.
So here I was on a troop train again, and they sent us off to another base in North Carolina. And
to be a gunner, huh?
I could see what was going on. They don't force your hand that much in the military. They let you make decisions, but they put you in a position where you don't have too many decisions. So they gave me started giving me basic training, and that was strange because here I was a corporal, and I'd been in the Army now for well over a year, about a year and a half, and they started drilling us just like we were new recruits. And here most of us in there were sergeants and corporals and so forth. And we kind of resented being marched up and down the field by a private. So we started flexing our muscles and chewing gum in ranks and talking in ranks and things that are forbidden, you know. And so the day that we got pretty active with this, why we went to the chow hall, and we were standing in the line waiting to get fed, and here come all the brass I'd seen in a long time, and boy, when they came up there, why, we all stood at attention and saluted him. And he said, "I understand that you guys are giving your drill sergeant a bad time." And it got just as quiet as a mouse. And he said, "Well," he said, "I'll tell you something. He's your drill sergeant, and as long as he's your drill sergeant, you will take orders from him. And if those stripes are bothering you, we can soon take care of
them." Oh, dear.
So he said, "Now you get that. I hope you do, because if you don't, why, you're going to be seeing more of me." And so we went back to drilling, and they only drilled us one more day, and then they just give us a lot of time off.
Uh-huh.
We had nothing but time on our hands. And so they had a big fancy day room, they call them, where you can go in there and write letters and all that kind of stuff. So I got real busy and started writing all kinds of letters to my folks and anybody I could think of, my girlfriend back home and all that kind of stuff. And so the day room was just, it was wallpapered with beautiful posters of a guy with stripes all over his arms and
uh-huh.
campaign ribbons and a set of wings.
Uh-huh.
And it says, "Go to gunnery school and get your wings tomorrow and get your stripes soon after," or something to that effect.
Really programming you.
So I knew that I was a guy that was out in limbo, and if I didn't get myself reassigned, why, somebody was going to reassign me. And so I didn't go in the Army with the idea of goofing off or anything, and so I wanted to get actively involved again. And so I just went over and I signed the paper to go to gunnery school.
Uh-huh.
And I signed it along just before the sun went down, and by sundown I was told to get all my belongings together. I was shipping out. So I crammed them all in a duffel bag, got back on a troop train, and I wound up at Panama City, Florida.
Oh, for God's
sake. At a place called Tyndall Field, and that was gunnery school.
Uh-huh.
And gunnery school was only about 6 weeks long, and they gave us every opportunity to wash out of gunnery school. They didn't want any wimps for gunnery.
No, I don't suppose.
So they had one test there that was a toughie. We had to learn to field strip a 50 caliber machine gun blindfolded in 4 minutes.
Oh my gosh.
And you could do it pretty easy in 4 minutes if everything went like clockwork, because we'd taken these apart and put them together so many times that we knew the hang-ups. And the worst hang-up was what they call getting the breech lock put back together. And if you didn't get that just right, why, it wouldn't slip into place. And that would get you washed out of gunnery school. And nobody wanted to wash out of gunnery school at that point.
Yeah.
And so everybody tried really hard to pass that. And there were some that didn't pass it, but they were given second and third chances, I think.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I made it.
Oh.
And so I got my wings, and I got one more stripe right there after I got through with gunnery school, so I became a buck sergeant.
Uh-huh.
And let's see, where did we go from there? We went to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, by troop train again. Well, that was a holding place for getting crews together.
To go fight.
And
huh?
What they did, they gave us what they call travel orders. And our travel orders was from Sioux Falls, South Dakota to Tucson, Arizona.
When did you get to go to the war?
So I went to Tucson, Arizona, and on the way to Tucson, Arizona, these travel orders had it fixed so that you could pick your crew. They had the crews numbered with your name with that number on it, and you were supposed to find who was the other members of your crew by that number.
Oh.
So we studied that for a while going along on the troop train headed for Tucson, and it wasn't too long until we got it all figured out and we started looking for our crew. And one by one we found the crew and found what his name was, and then we put a star by it so that we could make it up on this piece of paper what our whole crew was, and would get acquainted with them that way and remember who they was.
Uh-huh.
So by the time we got to Tucson, Arizona, well, we knew exactly who our crew was, and they were scattered all over the country. My pilot was from Indianapolis, and so was my co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And the navigator was from Massachusetts, Boston, Massachusetts. The bombardier was from Pennsylvania, and I was the top turret gunner, engineer gunner, they call him, and I was from Utah at the time, Bear River City. Radio operator gunner was from Whitman, Massachusetts. The ball turret gunner was from Savannah, Georgia.
How many gunners did they have?
They had, there was 11 of us on the crew, four what do you call them, commissioned officers,
uh-huh.
And all the rest of us were what they call non-commissioned officers, so there was 11 on a crew of a B-24.
But how many were gunners?
Six.
Okay.
Four commissioned officers and six non-commissioned gunners.
Okay.
And they all had different positions according to small gunner wound up in the tail. We had a guy from Norfolk, Virginia. The ball turret gunner was generally a fairly small guy, and he had armament training. He knew more about machine guns than anybody else did, and so he was the ball turret gunner, and he was from, Savannah, Georgia, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the waist gunner was, he was just gunner, and he came from Buford, Georgia.
My goodness.
So we were a pretty diverse crew.
Yeah.
And so we started out flying B-24s right off the bat. The pilot and co-pilot had to go out, and I went out with them because the pilot and co-pilot don't go anyplace in an airplane without an engineer gunner. So we flew two missions for them to get acquainted with the B-24, because they'd never flown the B-24 before. They'd graduated as pilots, but they had flown out of
nothing like first-hand experience.
So we flew missions then, and that lasted about 2.5 months, and we really did a lot of flying. And of course, we'd already had our training for shooting at tow targets and stuff when we was in gunnery school. So we knew how to operate our turrets and all that kind of thing. And this B-24 had a Martin turret that I manned, and it had a sit-down seat. You'd get there and you'd pull the seat up under you, and then you ride on your mission in a sit-down seat.
Didn't they all have sit-down seats?
No.
Oh, so you were lucky, huh?
Yeah. Well, I was at that point. But we trained in the B-24s, and we really didn't, none of us liked that B-24 that well. We had all kinds of nicknames for it, and they wasn't very nice names. So anyway, we graduated from our, what we call our phase training, and we headed east again on a troop train, went to Lincoln, Nebraska, and got our overseas clothes all issued to us and so forth. When they were all issued to us, the whole crew moved to Camp Miles Standish back by Boston. Again, we were held for a while till we got the shipping orders, and they wouldn't let us off the base. We were stuck to the base, so that was almost 2 weeks, I think. And, of course, by then we were getting pretty antsy. We knew that we were going to war, and we wanted to get there and see what it was all about. Because we were green as a gourd. We didn't have the slightest idea what we was walking into. So anyway, on December the 12th of 1944, we marched on the USS Wakefield, which used to be the luxury liner Manhattan, four abreast, and we marched on about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and they continued to march four abreast onto that ship until midnight.
Oh my gosh.
And that was one big troop carrier, I'll tell you. And we headed out in the North Atlantic about 2:30, I think it was, out into the North Sea. And we got into a storm out there, and I mean, it was rough. We were right below deck, right where the anchor, when it would swing out in the rough water, it would come back and hit the side of the ship.
Oh my gosh.
Sound like a great big rough bell, you know.
Oh.
Well, there wasn't hardly anybody in my area there that didn't get seasick.
That's what I was wondering.
And we were laying there in bunks that were so close together, tiered bunks.
Claustrophobia.
That if we turned over, we would bump the guy above us and below with our hips.
Oh my gosh.
And
if you had to throw up.
Here we was seasick, so naturally we couldn't stay in the bunk for too long. And so I got up, and I went into what they call a latrine there, and they had a big metal box type thing. What it was a holder of wash pans. They had just regular wash pans that were, you just set them in this here big trough, and Everybody washed in there. So this was a faulty one, and they'd taken it off the wall, but they hadn't got it out of the ship, and so it was just laying upside down there. And so I was so sick that I couldn't hardly hold my head up, and I noticed the guy had got on that trough, and he was sicker, I think, than I was. And the ship was so rough, and the water and stuff had accumulated in the latrine area there, and he was riding that trough back and forth.
Oh my gosh.
And it would hit one wall, and he'd hang on, and then it'd hit the other wall, and every time it did that, I splashed that stuff all over.
Oh my gosh.
But I was too
sick.
I was too sick to help him. So all I could do was watch him. But anyway, I was sick. It took us 14 days to cross the ocean, and now that's a fast ship. It could do it in 4 days if it didn't do a zigzag course, but we had no escort whatsoever. We were out there on our own, and they wouldn't let us off above deck because they was afraid somebody would strike a match and it'd give our position away.
Oh my.
And they knew how long it took submarine to line up to fire a torpedo at you. So they run what you call a zigzag course from the east coast to England. And that's why it took 14 days. And furthermore...
Why you were so sick.
Yeah, furthermore, they decided that it'd be better. Just about everybody on board the ship was deathly sick, you know, and they couldn't really do much for them. So they went south, paralleled the coast until we got down to the Gulf Stream, and it was a lot quieter. And then we did that zigzag course all the way to England, landed at Liverpool.
Were you still sick by the time you landed?
Well, I was sick right up until we landed, but I wasn't quite as sick the last 2 days as I had been previously. The only thing that I ate from the time I left the East Coast was soda crackers.
Oh.
And very few at all.
Oh, that land looked wonderful.
And so when I walked off the gangplank, I was no longer sick. I went to food and I ate a lot.
So how long were you at war?
We were at war from what they did. They sent us to a base. We landed at Liverpool and they took us again by English train this time. That was a new experience. They took us to a base quite a long ways from Liverpool, way south down towards. We were 90 miles out of London. Awful close to Cambridge,
mm-hmm,
England,
mm-hmm.
And they signed us to a base there at Ridgewell, and it was the 381st Bomb Group. It had four squadrons in it, 532nd, 533rd, 534th, and 535th, and we were the 532nd. So, then, lo and behold, we found ourselves after all that training in B-24s on a B-17 base.
Isn't that typical?
So the pilot, co-pilot, and myself all had to go to a couple of days of schooling to learn the features of a B-17 because they were quite different from a B-24. And know all about transferring fuel if we got to where we had to transfer fuel from one tank to another, and all the mechanical features in case we could do something in flight that would help us out mechanically and that sort of thing. And then after we'd done the ground school there, then the pilot, co-pilot, and myself started the flying. And